Welcome to the podcast that helps you build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. This is the Rebel Capitalist Show.
Hello, fellow Rebel Capitalists. Hope you're well. Hope you had a great weekend. You're enjoying your Sunday evening or afternoon. Ready to dive into your questions. Before we do that, I want to encourage you to check out RebelCapitalistLive.com. It is the amazing, incredible live conference that I do twice per year. We usually have about 12, 13 speakers. We've got about 7 or 8 of them booked so far. I just booked Doug Casey and Steve Van Meter. And we've got a ton of amazing people that will be there, fellow Rebel Capitalists and like minds. Very important in today's day and age with all the insanity in the world, that's for sure. That's one of the main reasons I like doing them, is just to go and surround yourself with like-minded people, sane people, for heaven's sakes, for a weekend. And it really kind of recharges the batteries. So anyway, check that out at RebelCapitalistLive.com. Get your tickets today before they sell out and before the prices increase as we get closer to the date. All right, let's dive into your questions, see what we got for this evening. Are you starting to ease into commodities or waiting for a general pullback? Well, I eased into commodities in March of 2020. So, I kind of added to my position. I changed around a little bit. I had to sell to that coal position because the ETF I had, it went up. I don't know what it did. It tripled or quadrupled. And then they dissolved it if that's not a great contrarian indicator. But I started investing in commodities back then. So, as far as adding to the position, I'm personally waiting for a pullback. I think what we're seeing in the yield curves right now would indicate that there's a reasonable probability that we could see equity and commodity prices come down for a variety of reasons, especially with the Fed continuing to tighten because of inflation. I think they'll tighten until they break the market. But long term, I think we're in a super cycle. That started in April or May of 2020. And those usually go 10 or 15 years. So no, they don't go up in a straight line. And sometimes they have huge, huge pullbacks. But for me, that's just going to be a buying opportunity. I mean, I was even thinking through it this weekend. And I just don't see how commodity prices aren't higher in 5 years. Unless they take a dip down because we have a big economic shock or a shock to the financial markets, like the stock market. We have some huge black swan event but I don't think they'll stay down for a very long time. I mean, you've got to look at the decisions that are being made by the Western governments. So as an example, I just tweeted it out. I can reference it right here. Yeah. So according to a couple different news sources that I have seen, German retail chains, and this is, I think their biggest one is Aldi, if I'm not mistaken. So the grocery stores have announced that from Monday forward, they will increase food prices by 20 to 50%. Now, I'm assuming this is accurate because I have seen it in a couple places. It may not be. We'll have to see wait to see how this plays out. But this is an example of governments just, and maybe you got to say the people in society at large, willing to pay just an unbelievable price to virtue signal. That's what we're dealing with here. Because you look at what sanctions are. Sanctions, I mean, look at what they're doing to Russia. Right. Look at the vlogs that I've encouraged you guys to watch. Now, are they affecting the individual? Yeah, they are. They are. Is it going to stop Putin from doing whatever he wants to? No, it's not. Not at all. Not in the least bit. And the only thing that sanctions usually do is they just hurt the innocent people on both sides. And that's exactly what we're seeing in Germany. I think we'll see the same type of price increases with food here in the United States, maybe to a lesser degree. Hopefully to a lesser degree, but I wouldn't be surprised if you see a headline like this in the United States in a month or two. And so what that tells you is if you're a politician, you, we've got to assume their number one objective is to be reelected. So having that assumption, then you've got this balancing act, right? You've got a society that wants to virtue signal, and they want to do anything against Russia and Putin because they're hyper emotional. So they want to feel like they're doing something, even if they're not. They don't want to look into, is this actually having a benefit? Is this actually deterring Putin? Is this actually deterring Russia from continuing what they're doing in Ukraine? They don't want to think about that. They don't want to get into the nuance. It's just like the monkey, you know, with the hands over the ears and over the eyes. They just want to ignore that because that gets in the way of making it feel like they're doing something, even though in reality they're not. They're just hurting themselves. So what's astonishing is the level or the price, the cost that society is willing to pay just to feel good, or the willingness to lower their standard of living just so they can feel better about themselves. So this is, you're the politician, you're like, okay, well, if I don't virtue signal, then these people aren't going to vote for me. So they're willing to take an extreme amount of pain. So I'm going to keep giving them the pain until they're like, no, this is too much. Now the prices are too high. I can't put food on the table. Now we don't like the sanctions because we realize the cost is too great. And now I think, and once they get to that point, then they'll start to rationalize it by then looking into the economics of it and seeing, oh yeah, this actually doesn't work. So therefore, we can pull back these sanctions and still feel good about it because we're following the economics, just like we're following the science, same type of deal. So, I mean, having said that, let's just say that what's happening in Russia, Ukraine ended tomorrow. Is this insanity with the Western societies going to change anytime soon? I don't think so. I think they're just going to go from one hysteria or outrage to the next hysteria outrage. We went from the Cerveza sickness, we go to Russia, Ukraine, and it's going to be something else. And each time we go to the next form of outrage or the next topic of outrage, I think it's going to grow. The virtue signaling is going to grow. The cancel culture is going to grow. The mob mentality is going to continue to grow. I think this is just what you get in a fourth turning. So what's my point? How does that play into commodities? Because even once we're done with Russia, Ukraine, hopefully it ends quickly, I think people get right back into wanting to feel good regardless of what the benefit is or perceived benefit. They're not even going to look into that. And they're going to get right back onto this ESG movement. I think the politicians, the global elite especially, that want the societies to reduce their consumption levels and population growth, and therefore the standard of living and the economic activity and whatnot, they're going to, you know, in the name of climate change, of course, they're going to push for these countries to go to more green energy, right? So what that means is less investment into supply of fossil fuels, which at the end of the day, the demand is very inelastic. You can sit there and, you know, again, this is what we're seeing now. You can virtue signal all you want. And at the end of the day, your hot water heater doesn't care about your virtue signaling. The grocery store doesn't care about your virtue signaling. The farmer producing your food doesn't care about that. They just care about the bottom line. And people are going to have to pay the price. But my point there is I think people are going to be willing to pay a higher price. They're going to be willing to reduce their standard of living. And therefore, you're going to see less and less and less investment go into oil, coal. I think they'll start to ease into nuclear. So nuclear is with uranium. I think they'll kind of gravitate over there. But that will probably be a gradual process. And there's going to be a lot of pushback in that as well. So this is kind of how I see the world moving forward. And that, among other reasons, is why I think we're in this commodity super cycle that will have ups and downs. I'm waiting for another downturn in the short term and to take advantage of kind of adding to the position and express kind of that long-term view. If the 10-year yield spikes and money starts flowing out of equities, what is the probability of the Fed buying mutual funds, ETFs? I think very high. that's, I mean, you see this gradual progression with the monetary heroin. It starts with QE, then it does, or it starts with artificially low interest rates, then you do QE, and you do QE 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, infinity. And then that's not enough. So then you've got to do a set of special purpose vehicles to backstop corporate debt. And then it's just, you got to add more and more and more, just like the drug, just like the heroin addict. To get the same high, you need more and more and more of whatever it is you're injecting into your vein. And what we're doing is we're just injecting the funny money into the system. Now, the transfer mechanism, I would disagree with a lot of people. I don't think it's just a result of the Fed increasing the size of its balance sheet. Most of you know that, or my position there. I completely agree with Snyder, and that just that in and of itself really doesn't do anything, unless the Fed is buying directly from individuals. But it would require a third party, in the sense that the government would have to deficit spend in order to, because you'd have to create new dollars that were getting into the system via the government spending. And so if that was happening as a result of the Fed buying a lot of the debt, then you'd see M2, I know it's not a very good measurement, but you'd see the amount of dollars in the real economy circulating, or the amount of dollars in the real economy chasing goods and services actually increase. So you guys, I've done a ton of whiteboard videos on that, but I don't want to get too far down the rabbit hole on that topic. But so my point there is, when you see the next downturn, I think they're going to have to pull out more ammunition. So what's next? I mean, that they've bought corporate debt, buying equities, right? I mean, it's just kind of the Japan playbook without the deflation. It's the Japan playbook with high levels of inflation. That's kind of what we're seeing here play out in the U.S. But what's interesting is we're seeing massive inflation in Europe, as we just mentioned. It's probably going to get a lot worse. And you're actually seeing quite a bit of inflation in Japan as well. So, I mean, the world is going to most likely experience some severe pain in the next few years as a result of stagflation. Again, that doesn't mean that inflation goes straight up. That's another mistake that people make. They think that it just goes from 6.5 to 7.5 to 7.9 to 10 to 15 to 20 to 40, and then it's hyperinflation. That's not the way it works. Look at the 1940s, look at the 1970s even, and you'll see that inflation doesn't go up in a straight line. Goes from 7.9 to 8.5, then back down to 7.5, then back down to 6, then up to 10, then up to 12, then back down to 8. And you know, it's volatile like everything else. Now, you could argue that back in the 70s, you could get positive real rates. That's true. Back in the 40s, you can get positive real rates. And you still had inflation go from 19% in 1947 down to -2 within a matter of a couple years. And so if it can happen in the 1940s, it can definitely happen in the 2020s. It's just a matter of aggregate demand, which is a matter of, in my opinion, government deficit spending. And how are they spending that? Is it just, you know, as an example, if they started doing more stimmies tomorrow, and to the degree to which they did stimmies in 2020, and just made that permanent, okay. Now you've got some massive aggregate demand that most likely is, although I think inflation would still go up, then down a little bit, then up, then down a little bit. You know, it'd still go up in a kind of a stair step way, or kind of a, you know, like a mountain range. It's just not going, it's not linear, I guess is what I'm trying to say. That would mean we're going to see something more like the 70s than the 1940s. That's for sure. But it's about government spending. I mean, if the government continues trillion-dollar deficits, that's not going to cut it, because you got to increase it. You got to ever increase it, or else prices just get to a high water mark and then start to flatline and go up, a little slower. So, you know, what's going to happen when? And you know, I listened to Zoltan. He did an interview that's on YouTube. I think the channel is Financial Repression. It's not Financial Repression. I'm trying to remember the channel name. it's not Financial Repression Network. It's Financial Repression Analytics or something like that. But he did a pretty good interview with these guys. And, you know, his kind of base case when looking at the yield curve is that, yeah, it's flat and that should be a recession, but I don't think it's going to be because the government's going to come in and deficit spend just like they did in 2020. And so that he's not really buying the yield curve. And again, if they do that, then you're going to see 1970s. If they don't do that for whatever reason, because there's political gridlock or what have you, then you're most likely going to see the 1940s. But even if you see the 1940s, that's still, I mean, okay, is that really good when we go 2 or 3 years with inflation at 20% and then you go back down to where it's okay, now it's just 3 or 4%, then it spikes back up to 15-20%. I mean, that's by no means a good outcome. That's still extremely bad. And the standard of living is going down dramatically. But yeah, I think the Fed knows that they can't allow equity markets to tank. It's just, and they're going to do everything they can to prop them up. I don't think that's a reason to buy. I would never buy for that reason, just because you think the Fed's going to do something. But I think that's their playbook. What role will commercial banks play in the CBD? Pretty much the same role they play now. I mean, now all they are is just they're like a lead generator, or they're like a mortgage company, or a mortgage company that just does the paperwork. They're like salespeople. Where, you know, you got these mortgage companies where they're just like a marketing firm. They just run advertising on the radio or on Google or online or whatever. And then they generate the lead and then they basically do the sale. But there's a back end entity that may be part of that company or maybe part of a different group that actually lends the money. They're just kind of a front man for it. And then they just take a commission, basically. They're just like a salesman. And so that's pretty much most of the banks. I think that's what they do now. The majority of their lending, they don't keep that on their books. They might issue the loan, but then they just shoot it straight over to Fannie and Freddie. And then they just take the fee. They just pocket a little bit of a spread. So I think that's the same thing that they'll do in the future, even with a CBDC. People say, oh my gosh, you know, it's going to put the banks out of business and all these. Not really. Again, that would imply that right now the big banks are making a lot of money by keeping loans on their books. I don't think they are. So they'll just pocket a fee for being a middleman and then just being kind of a branch of the Federal Reserve. I mean, that's all they are right now anyway. I mean, look at Bank of America. Look at Wells Fargo. Look at Chase. Look at these big banks. All they are is just an extension of the government. I mean, they're so regulated. Is there any difference between Wells Fargo and B of A? No, they're identical, other than just a little logo, because they're so heavily regulated. The government just, it's like fascism. I mean, sure, they might be privately held, but the government pretty much controls everything. So you don't have any choice when it comes to your bank, unless you go with like a credit union or a small community bank or something like that. So I think it's just pretty much the exact same thing. I don't see how it would change too much. I think the big thing that would change is since the Fed is backstopping everything and they have an infinite balance sheet, I think the lending standards would change quite a bit. I think they'd go from a credit score to a social score, because even now, even if the banks aren't keeping the loans on their books, the people that are buying those loans still care about a credit score. So that's still how they're initiating the loan. You know, they've got standards. They've got like a checklist for Fannie and Freddie for underwriting. So I think that's really what changes is the underwriting for the loan. Hey guys, I want to remind you to check out Rebel Capitalist Pro. This is the incredible online investment forum that I have with investment experts Lynn Alden and Chris McIntosh. It includes professionals such as Patrick Serezna from Macro Voices. He specializes in options.
Tony Greer, commodity trading, Jason Hartman, real estate, and Brent Johnson with macroeconomics. If you want to build wealth and thrive in this world of out-of-control central banks and big governments, Rebel Capitalist Pro is the resource you need. So check it out today at georgegammon.com/pro. That's georgegammon.com/pro. We'll see you inside with the fellow Rebel Capitalists that are taking their investing to the next level.
Would you consider doing a whiteboard on what exactly free banking is and how it is more beneficial than the system we have today? Well, you can just Google it. It's very easy, really. Free banking is just banking without the government, without a central bank. So you just, back in the day, you just take your gold, you give it to a bank, they'd give you currency, just IOUs for that gold. And then you could trade that those IOUs with whomever you wanted. And they could take that IOU, then go down to your bank, and they could get the gold, or they could just trade those IOUs with other people. And everyone accepted them because they knew that they were backed by the gold that was held in the bank. And if they wanted to, they could just go down to the bank and grab their gold. So each bank, in fact, issued their own currency. And most of the banks knew each other, so you could use one bank's currency at another bank and whatnot, and they're kind of interchangeable. But that's how we did things from, 1836, if my memory serves me right, to the Civil War. And so that's all it would be. Just and banks would have to hold their loans on their balance sheet. You wouldn't have Fannie and Freddie. But that said, people say, oh my gosh, I would love that. Okay, but be careful what you wish for. Because now, even here in the United States, even with the dollar as the reserve currency, you wouldn't have a 30-year fixed rate mortgage. That doesn't exist in a free market. That only exists because the government backstops it, or the taxpayer really backstops those loans. Americans think that that's just a normal market type of product, and it's not. Try to get a 30-year fixed rate mortgage in Australia or Europe or something. You're not going to find it. Because, I mean, if you were a bank, would you do that? Would you give a 30-year mortgage right now to someone at a fixed rate for 4% or 4.5% or whatever? Absolutely not. You'd have to be out of your mind. And so the only person that would, or the only entity that would issue that type of mortgage is an entity that doesn't care about a profit and loss because they're backstopped by the taxpayer. Anyway, I totally believe free banking is the best system that imperfect human beings in an imperfect world can create. And I think that's the way we should go. But again, you would see the housing market go down significantly in the United States because you wouldn't have those 30-year fixed rate loans. Let's say Russia withdrawals tomorrow, sanctions are removed. What does the world look like? Lines have been drawn, sides have been chosen. I don't know what Russia does there. I don't know if they continue to require payment in rubles. I think if they do, it gives you kind of a tell on what was the real objective behind Ukraine. That's something that I've been saying on a lot of my videos, where if you look at how Russia is playing their cards, it seems like this was part of the plan as far as requiring rubles for oil or natural gas or commodities. It just seemed like when I read about their responses in the media, and you know, with the Western media, it's being kind of manipulated or spun. It seems like it was pretty well thought out. And so I've been kind of trying to ask myself the question, is Ukraine really about Ukraine, or is Ukraine really about the United States and dethroning the dollar? Because if I'm Russia, even if I get what I want in Ukraine, I still know that the United States can kind of just freeze my FX reserves, as an example. The United States has a significant amount of control over my domestic economy. Now, I don't think they have the control to the degree to which the mainstream media would like you to believe, and the United States and the West would like you to be, not even close. But they've got a hell of a lot more control over the Russian domestic economy than Colombia does, or than Australia, or Japan, or something like that, right? And hey, if I'm a country, I don't care who it is, Russia, Japan, China, Saudi Arabia, Colombia, I don't want another country to have that type of control over me. I don't know about you. That would not help me sleep well at night. So, you know, even if they get what they want there, my point is they still have this kind of burden. They still have to be leery of kind of the whims of the United States. And I would say that's a much bigger problem long term than whatever is going on in Ukraine. And therefore, it would surprise me if they backed down off the ruble deal, unless that was really a negotiating chip that they used to get something that was really, really important to them, whatever that is. I don't know what's important to them. Maybe saying that you know, Ukraine isn't going to join NATO or something like that. But I think they would really like to continue that move. But even if they don't, I think the damage has been done, because it's just like the United States using the nuclear bomb in World War II. It showed all of the countries that were even friendly to the United States that they're willing to do it. And therefore, all these other countries started their own nuclear program, because they're like, whoa, time out here. You know, we see the United States use that against Japan, and maybe, you know, we're friendly with the United States now, but maybe we won't be in 10 years, or maybe we won't be in 15 years. So I think the same thing has happened with this freezing of the FX reserves and the sanctions and a lot of these other kind of pushback from the West. And we've seen Saudi Arabia say, hey, we want to start doing business with China in yuan. You've seen India say, hey, we want to start doing business with Russia in rubles. And I think that trend is going to continue. I think that's done. That cat is out of the bag. As far as, you know, does the dollar lose its reserve status immediately? No. It takes a long, long time for these things to happen. It takes years for this to play out, but you got to start somewhere. And I think we're moving in that direction. And if, I don't know if it is, but if that was one of the objectives of the invasion, then they have achieved that objective. And I think what the West has done is it's really, you know, the economic decline is a result of a self-inflicted wound. And, you know, Zoltan in that interview points out that although we had these sanctions that the West imposed on Russia, they had large cutouts for commodities. But what happened is all of these corporations just wanted a virtue signal. So they said that, oh, we're not going to do business with Russia, even though these sanctions have cutouts in them for us to continue to do business in Russia. Okay, well, that's why you got to pay 10 to 50 or 20 to 50% higher food prices in Germany. That you can chalk that up to woke virtue signaling by corporations. Good job. So a lot of that was unnecessary. And again, that's just, I think the West is sowing the seeds of their own demise, ironically, from the unintended consequences of just this outrage type of hysteria culture that we've become accustomed to, that has now bled into not just corporate America, but corporations globally in the West. And, you know, one of the things that I'm doing, and I got this idea from my good friend Chris McIntosh, and I think it's a brilliant observation on his end is you got to look at countries who aren't going to play that game, who are going to look at kind of the cancel culture and the outrage stuff, and just they're not going to play ball. And but I'll get into those ideas in some whiteboard videos maybe this week or next week. But I think that's what you've really got to start paying attention to moving forward, is even if things do end tomorrow, you know, what alliances have been formed here as a result. I would argue Saudi Arabia, Russia, India, China, maybe Brazil, the BRICS, if you will. And I think that's going to get stronger and stronger as a result of these unintended consequences from the governments being short-sighted in the West and just saying that we know these sanctions won't do anything, but it'll make people feel good and vote for us. Therefore, that's what we're going to do. And then you have the third and fourth layer effect that means all these other countries that are commodity rich and have commodities that we will need in the future are saying, yeah, that dollar thing, we're not going to play that game anymore. What would you recommend for a new college graduate to do? No student loans or credit card debt? I would just go somewhere where your expenses are going to be a lot lower. I mean, I'm assuming you're in the United States. I mean, I'm in Medellin, Colombia right now, and the quality of life here is just as good, if not better, than anywhere I know of in the United States. But your cost of living is just nothing. So if you could figure out a way to earn dollars and be a part of you know, where you're selling to the United States, you're selling to Australia, you're selling to Europe, you're selling to these other places, but yet you're living. So you're selling your product or your service to high cost areas, and you're living in low cost areas. And then you just pocket the difference and then reinvest that back into the business to grow at a faster rate, or take that spread and start your investment portfolio. That's what I would do. I mean, I would try to figure out how I could make $4,000 or $5,000 a month online as quickly as I possibly could. And then I would come down to Medellin, Colombia. I'd enjoy my life, your expenses, let's say, you know, $1,500 a month. And whereas if you were in the United States doing that, you'd just be living paycheck to paycheck, so to speak, or just kind of hand to mouth. If I was just graduating, that's exactly what I would do. I don't know that there's a downside to that. If there's a downside, I don't know of one. Yeah. So I see someone looking at saying that they're still selling $5 rotisserie chickens, but don't let that fool you. In business, this is what we call a loss leader. So what they're doing is they're doing the $5 chickens because they know you'll go there to get a $5 chicken. And they're, let's say, losing a dollar on that or $2, but they know you're going to buy, you know, a lot of other stuff where they've marked it up 50%. That's usually that's usually how that game is played. Hey guys, I want to remind you to get your tickets to Rebel Capitalist Live. This is the live conference I do twice per year with all of your favorite speakers from the Rebel Capitalist Show and experts in investing, commodities, real estate, freedom, and liberty. All of your favorite topics, all of your favorite speakers. The next Rebel Capitalist Live is going to be in Miami, and tickets increase in price as we get closer to the event. So go to rebelcapitalistlive.com right now to get your tickets to the next Rebel Capitalist Live. It's the conference you cannot afford to miss. It'll help you increase your financial freedom and, more importantly, your personal freedom. You'll get intel that you won't hear anywhere else. Past speakers have included icons in macroeconomics, investing, and personal freedom and liberty. People like Dr. Ron Paul, Robert Kiyosaki, Brent Johnson, Lynn Alden, Jeff Snyder, Richard Werner, Mark Moss, Lynette Zhang,
and Robert Breedlove, just to name a few. So once again, go to Rebel Capitalist Live right now and get your tickets today.
Yield curve inverted Friday. Do you think the Fed will raise rates quickly or let inflation run hot? Yeah, I mean, I think they'll raise rates until they break the market, and then they'll just desperately try to prop the market back up. Like, that's the cycle we're in right now. And I would not want to bet on them being able to prop those markets up. And look at Japan. That doesn't always work. It's worked in the United States so far. But who knows? At some point, the market is definitely stronger than the Federal Reserve. And we can see that in the long end of the bond market. The Fed only has so much power. And you say, well, they can buy stocks and they can do that. Oh, yeah, they did that in Japan too. And sometimes that's not even enough. It probably would be. But how long does that last? I don't know. I don't know. But I think that's the game we're playing here. Raise rates until you break the market. And then once the market's broken, try to fix it through monetary heroin or just backstopping, just jawboning, and through government deficit spending. I just look, if inflation is still at 7.9%, that's where it gets interesting. Because if you're the government, how do you deficit spend into that? I mean, I guess they could do price controls. I think that's probably where you go with it. You say, okay, we're going to do UBI and we're going to do price controls. And so that may be the way they try to navigate that, to get more dollars to buy your vote, while at the same time trying to keep the prices down, or making you think like they're doing something to keep the prices down so you'll vote for them. That's probably my base case. In fact, I'm just thinking through this out loud. Raise rates, break the market, backstop the market, deficit spend, price controls, and throwing a CBDC in there. What do you propose to fix the U.S. debt problem? Well, it's not unfixable. I mean, if you get enough inflation, you're gonna solve your debt problem. But it's not going to be without cost. It's just, who's going to pay? And the poor and the middle class would pay for that because of a loss of purchasing power. It's just the hidden tax of inflation. You could do that, or you could just stop the deficit spending and the economy would collapse. Stock market would collapse. Housing market would collapse. And you'd have to endure some pain, some serious, serious pain. And then you'd be able to build on a stronger foundation moving forward. That's what I would do, but the politicians are going to try to avoid that at all cost. And I think the only way that we'll see that play out is if the market makes it play out. Like, if the market overwhelms the Fed and the government to where it just says we're not playing this game, like the long end of the curve. If they lose control over that, and that's the bond market saying, no, we're not, we're going to create deflation for you in asset prices, then, you know, that would be the scenario where the bond market would force the government to solve its debt problem quickly. But I think that although that's possible, I don't know that that would be the base case. I think the base case is just stagflation, or try to create stagflation, try to continue to just kick the can down the road. And this is what we're seeing in Europe, right? I just did a video on this the other day where the European Central Bank is still doing QE. They're still doing pandemic levels of QE. And inflation there, I think, is its highest print in whatever, 30, 40 years. And they're still doing it. They still got their pedal to the metal, and they're just kind of making excuses. Oh, well, you can't do, yeah, we're going to stop QE in Q3. Yeah, we're just being sure. We just got to be safe here. We just got to be safe. And they're just kicking the can down the road because they're just trying to create stagflation. Or they're just trying to create inflation because they know that's the only thing that can bail out the government. That's the only thing that can, quote unquote, fix the debt problem. But again, that doesn't come without a cost. And the cost is just you're increasing taxes on the poor and middle class. That's all you're doing. And in other words, you're stealing their purchasing power through inflation. What am I doing to stay upbeat and happy when all this garbage is being piled on us from the politicians and mainstream media? Well, I mean, today I just went out. I'm a member of a country club here in Medellin, and I went out there. You guys know Angie and Joaquin. They're the husband and wife team that does all my real estate here. I took Joaquin and her kids out to the club, and I went out there and played golf. We had lunch with the kids, and then she took the kids to the pool, and they've got this whole, at this country club I'm a member of, they've got this whole entire setup for kids. It's not just a pool, but it's like an amusement park. It's crazy. And so they're doing that, and I was just relaxing, just having a coffee, just listening to a podcast, and then just hitting some golf balls and practicing and just kind of relaxing a little bit. So and then I'm trying to think of what the world will look like in 5 or 10 years. And I think there's going to be some incredible opportunities. Unfortunately, I don't think there's going to be a lot of opportunities in the West. And doesn't make me happy to say that, but it's a bizarre idea that I've been playing around with. I'm trying to think this through, and I haven't solidified my thinking on it, but a democracy only works if the people that are doing the voting are somewhat sane. If you have this mass formation psychosis, I think it's what it's called, and you have democracy, that can actually get real ugly. And we're moving into, especially if you have, like me, I'm kind of a firm believer in the fourth turning. If you think that is coming at us, and we won't be through that, and it will continue to get worse until 2030, I don't know that a democracy is the ideal setup for that type of environment where you're at the end of a fourth turning, and you've got this, and potentially this mass formation psychosis that Matisse Desmet, I think is how you pronounce his last name, has discussed with my good buddy Chris Martinson. And I believe he just came out with a book on the topic that I'm excited to get myself. I just heard Weinstein, Brett, talk about it with his wife, Heather, on their podcast. But my point is, over the next 8 years, I think it's the level of insanity and the level of psychosis with the cancel culture, with the outrage culture, with the hysteria culture, with the tribalism, with people just delegating their thinking to the central planners, and people just picking sides and seeing things just in black and white terms and without any nuance, and just good versus evil. That's not a healthy approach. And if you get that type of environment, if you get people with that, I don't even want to call it a mindset, when you get people that emotionally whipped up, democracy's, it's tough. I mean, you could think about if we had or how a democracy would play out if, it's a small town and you're doing like the Salem witch hunt, as an example. That doesn't end well. I mean, it's like my good buddy Rick Rule says that a democracy, if you've got two wolves and a sheep deciding what's for lunch, democracy isn't that great for the sheep. And I think in a normal, if we weren't at the end of a fourth turning, then I think a democracy or a representative republic is a good thing. But in a fourth turning, I almost think that, I don't want to use the word dictator, but if you look back at Singapore, they had a guy that was I don't know the exact setup they had there. And I should know this because I was in Singapore for quite some time. But they had a setup there where the guy was calling the shots and he couldn't get like unelected. he didn't have to get elected or something like that. I don't know if they called him a king or whatever, or a prime minister or something like that. But obviously there's some serious dangers in that. And normally there would be far more danger with that than there would be a democracy. But it's, I don't know. I'm thinking through, you know, for this fourth turning, you might want to look at countries who don't have elections and try to find that benevolent dictator out there, if there is such a thing. And that's where potentially, and it sounds crazy, but that's where capital could be treated the best just during this time of the fourth turning. And I don't want, I'm sure people are going to take this on social media and say, oh, George is against democracy and he, you know, he's crazy. He's a this, and this. That just don't take that out of context. It's just, it's an idea that I'm playing around with. Like what type of government is going to be the best in a world of imperfect, extremely, how do I want to say this? I think we're going into a time frame when we're not just imperfect human beings, we're even more imperfect than we usually are. and the world is incredibly imperfect, and you're going into this 8-year period where things are just gonna, most likely, and hopefully they won't, but most likely, we're on this slippery slope where it's gonna get more and more insane. You know, what type of government setup is the best for that environment? I don't know, maybe it is a government where the guy or gal doesn't have to worry about being getting votes, and where the guy or gal doesn't have to worry about being reelected. You just have to find where there's someone in charge that has their head on straight and isn't some sort of, you know, psychopath. I guess that's the challenge, but and maybe that doesn't exist. I don't know. But that's just kind of something I've been mulling over. All right, guys, I'll have to leave it there because I've got to get to another live stream for my mastermind group with the collective. So let me do some shout outs. And we've got Robin Olson. We've got Brian Moreland, RR in the house. Andrew Yetter, J. Dave. Peter Frauen. Good to see you, buddy. Joel Johnson, Peter Edwards, Wendell. Honey Badger, Now Nero, All Nighter Hider in the house, Alan Zibelman, Refined Hasid Appalachian, Gregory Nicholson, Paul Kish, KR33P3R Killer, Cretan, Robin Willis, then it looks like I'm not going to be able to pronounce that one, Nana, the angriest puppy in the house, State Line Enthusiast, Raven Mad, Charles Chen, Josh Calabi, Super Traveler, Rigo, Owen Thomas. All right, guys. Enjoy the rest of your evening. We'll see you on the next video.
Thank you for listening to the Rebel Capitalist Show. For more content like this, check out the Rebel Capitalist blog at georgegammon.com. Or go to the George Gammon YouTube channel.